Hello, I'm
Welcome
Nicholas Gordon,
to the New
host
Books
of the
Network.
Asian Review of Books podcast, done in partnership with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Today, we welcome back Glenn Wally, translator of classic Japanese novel Hakenden, to talk about his second translated volume, Hakenden Part 2, His Master's Blade. Unlike Part 1, all preamble, in Part 2, we meet some of the fabled eight dog warriors and the Confucian virtues they represent. Shino for filial piety, Gakuzo for duty, Dosetsu for loyalty, to name a few. There's betrayal, drama, and a lot of secret intertwined family relationships. Glenn Wally is a professor of Japanese literature at the University of Oregon and the author of Good Dogs, Edification Entertainment, and Hyokute Bakin's Nanzo Satomi Hakenden from the Cornell East Asia series, the first monograph-length study of Hakenden, a landmark of pre-modern Japanese fiction. Today, Glenn and I talk about Hakenden's Part 2, how this novel connected to readers at the time, and how Hakenden ends up being a lot like our Marvel Cinematic Universe. So, Glenn, thank you for coming back on the Asian Review of Books podcast to talk about the second volume of Hakenden, or Eight Dogs. Perhaps as a recap, or as a first recap question, what exactly is Hakenden? You know, what is this work? Who wrote it?
Excellent questions, all. And first of all, thank you for having me back. I'm really excited to be able to continue talking about this. So Hakenden, or Eight Dogs, is a really big and pretty important and I think really entertaining novel from mid-19th century Japan. It's written by a fellow named Kyokute Bakin, and I'll be calling him Bakin. That was his kind of personal name. It's a pen name. But if we're going to choose one of those two elements, we'll call him Bakin. And his dates are 1767 to 1848, and he serialized the book between 1814 and 1842. And it was really popular in its day, really influential on later generations of writers, critics, and continues to be influential in popular culture today.
And to stick with the recap, what happens in volume one? You know, what happens in the books before this volume?
Yes. So, as I mentioned, this is a serialized novel, and the translation is not appearing in the same divisions that the original serialization did. Of course, it's the same order. So part one of the translation covered the first 14 chapters of the book, and basically we can think of that as a prologue. The frame story, or the most basic plot line of this humongous novel, has to do with the Satomi family of feudal lords who are rising to power. And in part one, the first 14 chapters, that's all we meet. We're dealing with the Satomi family, primarily Satomi Yoshizane, who's the head of that family, and then his daughter, Princess Fuse, and the family dog, Yatsufusa. And we learn how Yoshizane sort of founds his kingdom or his lands, rises to power, deals with a bunch of enemies. Then we meet his daughter and the family dog. And in a moment of great crisis for his realm, his daughter, Princess Fuse, basically intervenes. The dog also intervenes and helps him out of a jam. But somehow, accidentally, the daughter ends up betrothed to the dog. And I will leave people to look at volume one for more details about that. I'll let it stand at they get married and go off into the mountains together. They live a chaste life together, but she ends up becoming pregnant with the dog's children. And when she discovers this, she's horrified, and she commits seppuku. She kills herself just as her father is trying to come up into the mountains to rescue her. And the eight spirits of these children that she's conceived, immaculately conceived with the dog, fly off into eight different corners of Japan, attached to eight beads from her Buddhist rosary. Does that sound confusing and strange? It is confusing and strange, but it's also a great little story in its own right. That's part one. It kind of ends with the death of Princess Fuse, but this foreshadowing that these eight spirit children of hers, and what are they really? have flown off into the eight corners of the land and what's going to become of them. That's part one.
So in volume two, we finally meet some of the dog warriors. I think there are four that kind of have, let's say, like reasonable introduction in the four volumes covered in this part two. Mm-hmm. Shino, Gakuzo, Dosetsu, and Genpachi. You know, I think let's maybe start with Shino because he's the protagonist. Seems like if the book has a protagonist, it's him. Why do you think he was made the central figure, at least in these four volumes?
Why was he made the central figure? In a sense, I might want to approach the question backwards. He appears to be the central character because he's the one who's introduced first. And perhaps I should step back and talk about the fact that we have these multiple protagonists. But right, so we have these eight spirits that have flown off into eight parts of the country. What we learn gradually over the course of part two, which we're talking about today, is that these spirits are then born into eight different families. They're human boy children, so they're not part dog, except that kind of by implication, we sort of feel there is a dog element to them, but they look, act, feel completely human. But they're born into separate families, right? And so we as readers meet them one at a time, and they don't know each other at first. They don't realize that they all have this sort of brotherhood from a previous incarnation until they meet each other and start to realize it. So we're meeting them one at a time. And the first one we meet is a guy named Shino. And because we meet him first and we really stick with him alone for several chapters, he really does sort of feel like the protagonist of this volume. But as we go along, ultimately each of the eight gets a chance to have his own solo adventure. And that's part of what makes the whole novel go on for so long, because he wants to give all eight of these guys a chance to shine and to be the star of their story arc, in a sense.
Yeah, and I will come back to this idea that everyone gets their own solo adventure, because there's an analogy that pops up when reading this part two. But we'll get to that later. A lot of the plot is driven by this sword, you know, the Rainmaker sword, which feels a bit like a MacGuffin at times, but it does drive the plot of a lot of these characters forward. Were weapons like this, were mystical weapons like this common in Japanese literature of the time?
To a certain extent they were. So basically, Rainmaker, as you mentioned, this is this sword. It's this heirloom for Shino's family. It's introduced in the context of Shino's father's story that we get at the very beginning of this part. It has magical powers. It also has this lineage. It goes back several generations and is associated with famous historical figures. And as you say, it kind of links the story together because it passes through multiple hands. Shino has it for a while. Spoiler alert, he loses it. Other people have it, and it continues to change hands for many, many chapters. And it's not really even resolved by the end of part two. And so it kind of links the storyline together, right? This kind of idea, and I think it's fair in a sense to call it a MacGuffin, because the book is not the story of the sword. The sword is there, but it's the story of the guys who interact with each other as a result of the sword. But items like this, magical items or family treasures, were really stock elements in adventure fiction from this time. People would have been totally familiar with the idea of, we've got a magical item introduced and this is probably going to be stolen. It's probably going to link these people together. It's probably going to be cases of mistaken identity, all of these things. He's kind of using the familiar story elements that everybody would have been expecting.
You know, maybe it's worth taking a big picture view of this part two. And I know it's a lot to say what happens in this part two, but what's kind of the quote unquote brief story summary of what happens in these four volumes?
So in essence, it's the origin stories for ultimately six of the eight dog warriors. So we as readers know there are going to end up being eight of these figures, because that's how many spirits Princess Fusei had at the end of part one, right? So we expect there's going to be eight, but rather than them being introduced all at once, we are introduced to them one at a time. And we get each of their backstories in succession, and we get each one of them introduced as his paths cross with the previous one who was introduced. So we're going to follow Shino for a while. Then we're going to meet another guy you mentioned, Gakuzo. This is the second one we're introduced to. Their paths cross, and ultimately they realize they have this kind of fated connection from a past life, and that pattern follows along. So in a sense, we as readers, part of the suspense or part of the thing we're looking forward to in the plot is, when are we going to finally meet all six? And then the second thing we're going to be looking forward to, when do we meet all eight? And then the second thing we're looking forward to is, when do all eight meet each other? Because as you'll soon discover, as we're getting into the second half of part two, in some cases, no sooner have they met than they're separated. Or they'll meet, we'll realize, ooh, this is a dog warrior, but he runs off following his own adventure. And so we're now sort of on this quest to reclaim this person who's appeared in the story. It's kind of a, if it's a story about dogs, it's kind of a cat and mouse story in that these people are kind of always a little bit elusive to us. So this is going to occupy the story for many chapters, and the author takes quite a while developing these backstories and really introducing each one of these eight characters before he brings them all together. Part two, we're actually only going to meet six of them. And I'm right now in the middle of preparing part three for the publisher. We're going to meet one more in part three, and then it's not going to be until part four that we meet the last of these. It really drags on for quite a while, but in a very interesting and eventful way.
It seems like there are plenty of bad people in this volume, in this part two, but it seems like the villains who pop up the most, and I think who drive a lot of the story for at least the first three of the Dog Warriors, are Hikiroku and Kamisaza. You know, this couple who have relations with Shino, they have relations with Gakuzo, they are involved in Dusetsu's story too. They're constantly messing around with the Rainmaker. Was that a character trope that readers at the time would have recognized, these kinds of people in authority abusing authority, generally being pretty yucky people?
Yeah, to a certain extent it was. And yet I think the author amplifies it to the point that it becomes really one of the overriding themes of Eight Dogs. So let me explain a little bit more about these people we're talking about. So I'd have to say that one of the central themes of this story is family ties and the loss of family ties. So all of these eight dog warriors ultimately realize that they have ties to the Satomi family, who we met in part one. They all each have their own families. And in Japan in the 19th century, to be part of a family meant, of course, to have certain obligations to parents, obligations to the family line, obligations to siblings. And that's how you sort of define yourself as a member of a family, is by observing these ties of filial piety. But so many of the dog warriors, in fact, all of them, in one way or another, find themselves orphaned. And when you're orphaned in this society, it means not only have you, you know, lost the emotional bonds you might have with parents, but you've lost this sense of being anchored in your society. You no longer have this web of filial bonds that are going to tell you who you are as a person, right? Or you might have them, but they're ties that you owe to people who are no longer there to reciprocate them, right? In the case of Shino, so we meet Shino first with his real parents, his biological parents. They die when he's very young, and he's adopted by his aunt and uncle, who are wicked aunt and uncle. But not just that, they've also usurped his family line. So not only are they mistreating him, but they've taken the position and the property that should rightfully have been Shino's. In fact, it should have been his father's, and they took it away from his father. So they're kind of petty officials in the villas where Shino grows up, but they're corrupt, they're wicked, and they're only looking at him as a way to bolster their own legitimacy in the eyes of the people. And so he should feel this sense of belonging to them. I mean, it is his aunt and uncle, and yet they're not letting him feel like part of the family. They're just looking at him as property. And so their villainy, they're kind of petty villains. They're not grand symbols of evil. They're just kind of corrupt, venal official types. But they end up getting their hands into the pie of all sorts of other people, including a number of the other dog warriors, before they finally meet their comeuppance. And this pattern sort of repeats itself with endless variation and detail with the other dog warriors. They all have these proper family ties that are somehow dashed, destroyed. They end up falling victim to corrupt officials. Sometimes the corrupt officials are really petty local people. Sometimes they're occupying some of the highest offices in the land. So we have these heroes, eight of them, who are all kind of orphaned, both in terms of family, and then they're kind of left as men without a country, in a sense. They end up running from the law through no fault of their own over and over again.
I mean, you mentioned family ties, it does seem like everyone is related to everybody in this book. You know, a new character will come up and is like, I'm actually this other guy's son, and we learned this, maybe Dosetsu is a good example of this, where he comes across Hamaji, and then it turns out that they're related, and they didn't quite realize it until then, and then Hamaji dies.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of this in the book. You kind of feel like you need like one of those charts with like pictures and like a pinboard to get all this together. But you know, I mean, is because it's about, kind of, you said, family ties and losing family ties. I mean, is having this kind of very complicated web of relationships kind of really that important to understanding this novel?
I think on one level it is, and it is definitely confusing at times. But I think on one level it is, and to be honest, I have a similar sense of like trouble keeping track of details and events, not just with this, but every time I go to see a kabuki play or read a kabuki play, kabuki plays also tend to have dozens of characters, all of whom are sort of related to each other and half of whom are in disguise at any particular time. So part of what we're dealing with is people just expected this from their fiction. Kind of like the way a modern, imagine going to see a superhero movie with someone who's not familiar with the tropes of superhero movies, who's never read a superhero comic. They'll be completely lost. But if you grew up familiar with these things, you're immediately able to identify, this is going to be significant. This is how these relate together, because you're familiar with the tropes of that kind of movie. Mm-hmm. I think audiences at the time probably just had this sixth sense ability to deal with multi-generational sagas like this and immediately put everybody in their place. It's not as easy for modern readers. That being said, I mean, I think he's a good enough storyteller that even if you're a little bit hazy on exactly how this person is relating to that person, each scene on its own tends to be exciting enough, and each storyline while you're in it is exciting enough to carry you along. Right. And I think that's part of what is going on with this sword. Right. After a while, you may be a little bit hazy on how these people are related to each other, but you know, this guy lost the sword. This guy has the sword. Guy A wants the sword back. Guy B wants to use it for his own purposes. Great. I get it. I can understand that level of the story. He gives us that pretty generously, I think.
You know, one of the things about the Dog Wars is that they all represent, I believe are they Confucian virtues or Buddhist?
Which they are Confucian virtues, yeah.
Yeah, Confucian virtues. So Shino is filial piety, you know, Gakuzo is duty, Dosetsu is loyalty. Right. You know, I mean, how important, you know, were these virtues, you know, quote unquote, in the Japanese society of the time?
So, you know, that's a fascinating question, actually. And this is one of the things I looked into when I was writing my I have a scholarly book on this that I wrote as a PhD student did the research for. All of these eight virtues, like individually, they would have just been sort of standard virtues that people would have taught their children. This particular set of eight of them does not seem to have been standard. People at the time would have talked about a list of five virtues or six virtues, but a list of eight virtues that is exactly these eight seems to have been something he sort of came up with to fit this story. He knew he wanted these eight heroes, and so he sort of like picks and chooses from the cardinal virtues a set of eight that he thinks work for him. But the individual virtues, like you say, we're talking about, you know, filial piety, wisdom, virtue, loyalty. These are just kind of the standard things that everybody would have taught their kids growing up. So in that sense, I don't want to use the word allegory because earlier, I think misunderstandings of this work thought of it as an allegory, and that doesn't do justice to how lively the characters themselves are. But certainly on some level, they represent these virtues. They have these magical beads that each one of these beads has the character for one of these virtues engraved on it. And each of these eight guys has one of these eight beads. These beads originally came from Princess Fuse's rosary, right, at the end of volume one. And these beads themselves, ultimately, we realize they sort of have magical protective powers. So they're each associated with one of these cardinal virtues because they have this bead.
So, I mean, maybe another kind of question about, you know, again, to kind of like, as I was reading the book, I was trying to like, again, like wrap my head around kind of the relationships between these characters in terms of the society at the time, kind of like, what are the dog warriors position? What's like Hikiroku and Kamatazu position, the, you know, the other lords positions, like what are the, like the social strata of right. the time and kind of where do these people vaguely fit?
Yeah. So the book is set in the 15th century. So in terms of Japanese history, that's the medieval period. And it's also a period of civil war. It's also called the Warring States period or Sengoku period. Mm-hmm. It's early in that period. And so the country is ruled by a shogun. The shogun's government is made up of various local feudal lords that are supposed to be loyal to the shogun. And this sort of pyramid of loyalty is supposed to go from the shogun to these regional warlords, to their retainers down to the village level, right? And when this system is working, everybody's loyal to the next stage up and everything is at peace. But this system is breaking down in the 15th century, and all of these local warlords are starting to go to war with each other, not pay attention to the shogun. Shogun's still around, trying to give people orders, and they're kind of not really listening. That's the world in which this is set. So we've got this kind of vestigial central authority, and we have lots of mention of someone who's a retainer of the shogun, or he's part of the shogunate, you know, the shogunal government. But then they always seem to be not really succeeding in holding on to power. They're always being challenged by these other warlords. And so there's this constant kind of vying for power in the background of the story. And sometimes the dog warriors run right into it. They become pawns in this power struggle between various lords. And sometimes it's just there in the background. And ultimately, far later in the story, we actually meet the shogun. One of the dog warriors goes to Kyoto, where the shogun is living, and meets him. So this is always kind of there in the background. And this is part of what makes for all the confusing relationships between characters, because, you know, these eight dog warriors are born into eight different families who are all going to be part of eight different domains. They're samurai families, which means they're part of this power structure, and yet this power structure, because it's fracturing and dissolving into internecine warfare, means that these guys are all, they could be from enemy territories, or they could be from territories that were enemies yesterday and they're friends today. And so they're, as they travel around, they're constantly having to navigate these treacherous political waters. And then I guess the other thing I would say about that historical setting is that when the author, Bakin, is writing this story, in the mid-19th century. He and his readers are still living under this structure. They're still living in a country that's ruled by this shogun, who is exerting power through regional lords, samurai lords with their retainers. But in Bakin's day, it's working. The country has been at peace for a couple of centuries under this type of regime, and the system, you know, for all of its flaws, seems to be functioning. So it's people who are living in an age of peace looking back at an age of civil war. And that's part of the flavor of this for readers, for original readers, I think. They're sort of looking back at an earlier stage of their own history when there's constant warfare and things are much less certain and secure than they are now.
So earlier in the interview, you mentioned that that there are similarities to superhero films, you know, where, you know, people mm-hmm. people go watch these films with an understanding of those tropes. And, you know, that does in reading this part two, I had this embarrassing thought pop my head a lot, which is this is just like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where you have characters show up, they make a cameo in the first guy's story, and then you have another whole chunk that talks about their background, much in the same way that you'll have, you know, I don't know, Captain America's shield pop up in one movie, and then you'll have a whole movie explaining his backstory. And then, of course, the end result is they all come together and they fight some, they fight the big bad at the end of the, at the end of the saga. You know, to give other kind of perhaps less embarrassing analogies, you know, it's like Japanese RPGs, you build a party of characters, or just like, I guess, you know, animes in general that are going to have these ensemble casts come together. You know, this is obviously very clearly a common narrative among many form of literature. But how do you see kind of like those kind of analogies across, like, I guess, across these centuries, where it's like Akenden is kind of doing a lot of the same sorts of narrative structures that we see in, you know, anime and superhero stuff and video games and stuff like that today?
I think all those are appropriate comparisons. And, you know, I'm a little bit embarrassed that the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe comparison, didn't occur to me as a, you know, as a nerdy literature professor. The comparison that occurred to me first was like the Three Musketeers, but I think the MCU in some ways is an even better comparison. So I think what we're dealing with is storytelling that is focused not on one single hero, but on a team of heroes. You know, we could draw comparisons with The Seven Samurai or with The Great Escape. I mean, any number of war movies across cultures focus on teams or platoons of people. And when you decide that you have a group of people at the center of the story, then it almost generates itself, right? Because each of those people, we get to learn their backstory, how they came to be part of this group, what their unique skills are that they're going to contribute to the group. And so, we see this pattern happening. I don't even know how old it is, but it certainly goes back into Chinese literary history. And Bakin is inspired by Chinese literary history, but we see it, you know, in Europe, we see it in the modern day, we see it all over the place. And I think, again, it's probably just the notion of having a team at the heart of the story, as opposed to a single hero like Odysseus, right? I think the Marvel comparison, if I could take it a little farther, and my academic colleagues might be shuddering to hear me say this, but I actually think it's a really good comparison, because if you were a real comic book nerd, when you went to the first Iron Man movie, you probably had in mind someday this guy is going to end up as part of this team, the Avengers, right? So you might be enjoying the Iron Man movie on its own terms, but ultimately looking to see how this guy is going to end up as part of this team, the Avengers. And so when the Avengers movies finally appear on the scene, you know, for those of us who are not part of that subculture, we think, oh, okay, they're just making a movie where they bring them all together. But for people who are part of that subculture, that's what they've been waiting for. We knew from the start that it was going to culminate in the Avengers. And with Eight Dogs, so he's invented these characters. These were not famous characters before he wrote the story. So it's not the same in that sense. But at the very beginning of part one, the first illustration in the entire book, if people will turn back, shows these eight dog warriors and gives us their names. So we know from the start, these are the eight heroes and they're going to come together as a team. And in a sense, every new one we meet, we're like, great, I can add another one to the list. We've reached that point in the story. And readers are, like I said before, readers are looking forward to the culmination of all this, I guess the Avengers moment, when they're all together and they can finally work as a team. And by the time they do, we've gotten to know each of them individually so well that we can see how each of them has particular strengths and not superpowers, but you know, character attributes that will allow them to play a different role in the adventure that they all have together. So I think the MCU comparison is really good, and I might steal that and use that sometime.
So normally I close off these interviews by asking, you know, what's the next project? I think you've already said what the next project is, which is translating part three. Yes. But I wonder if you might give us a teaser about what happens in part three. So at the end of part two, we have six of the eight. What happens next?
So at the end of part two, we have six of the eight together, and it seems like we're well on our way to assembling this team. And so if I was an original reader back in the 1820s when, or the late 18 teens, when part two finishes, I would be like, yes, we're almost there. In fact, we're going to have that gratification delayed quite a bit longer. What starts to happen very early in part three is that these teams that have come together start to break apart. So a character, mm-hmm. I won't even mention his name because he's not introduced until the end of part two. We think we've got him. He immediately disappears. In fact, he's kidnapped by a god. So he like disappears, like literally disappears, right? We don't know where he is. We don't know what's happening to him. And so we start to get this breaking apart almost as soon as we've come together. And so we have these prolonged searches. So we'll identify people, we'll come together, we'll agree we're brothers, and suddenly something happens, a big battle happens, and now we're all wandering alone in the wilderness. And we start to see this pattern. So we're only going to meet one new dog warrior in part three, but what we're going to see is a much, in a sense, more interesting, drawn out pattern of loss and longing, if you will. Part three is actually mm-hmm. pretty dark in a lot of ways.
Well, thanks for listening to our interview with Glenn Wally, translator of Eight Dogs or Hakenden, part two, His Master's Blade. So I've already asked the what's next question. So I'm going to go to my other standard post, you know, outro question, which is, where can people find your work? Not just this book, but all of your work.
So my other major work is, I sort of alluded to it. There's a scholarly book of essays or analyses of the Eight Dogs Project. And, you know, it's scholarly in tone, so I'm not sure that general readers will find it a page turner, but if you want more information about the book and a little bit of analysis of what I think is going on, it's called Good Dogs, Edification, Entertainment, and Kyokute Bakin's Nanso Satomi Hakenden, which is the original Japanese title. That is available from the same press, Cornell University Press. And that would be a good place to go. And I guess if you're allowing me to plug my own work, one of my other interests is visual art from the 19th century. And one of my projects that's more accessible is a website that I put together at the University of Oregon, where I teach, called Yokai Senja Fuda. So if people just Google Yokai Senja Fuda, S-E-N-J-A-F-U-D-A, they'll find the site, and it basically explores the culture of yokai, or traditional Japanese ghosts and monsters, through the medium of these really exquisite miniature woodblock prints from the late 19th century. That site is a lot of fun, and I use it in my teaching all the time. So that's where else you can find me.
You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on all of your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Jonathan Chatwin, author of The Southern Tour, Deng Xiaoping and the Fight for China's Future. But before then, Glenn, thank you so much for coming on the show again.
Thank you for having me.